Good evening, and welcome to Wednesday Night Bible Study. It's been a few weeks since we were able to meet together. I apologize for that. Of course, last week we had our 75th anniversary, and you knew in advance that we would not be having Bible study that night. But the week before, of course, as we all famously know now, I was coming down with COVID. In fact, by Wednesday, I was full-blown COVID, but I did not have my confirmation until the next day when I was able to go into the urgent care and get one of their wonderful rapid tests. In fact, I had two of them because the first test, which they're so uncomfortable when they stick the thing up your nose, both nostrils. It was supposed to be 15 minutes later and I'd get an answer. And the nurse comes back and just to tell me that the machine rejected my sample for whatever reason. So they had to do it again. So I got two tests back to back within 15 minutes of each other. And of course, when the second one went through, it came back as positive, which I probably knew it already just with how sick I was. But that was unplanned, and I apologize for having to cancel that night. But here we are. We're trying to finish Micah. We've been working through this book, only seven chapters of it, but we've been working on it for quite some time, really the whole summer. And we're down to our last 2 weeks. So if you have been hanging in there with us all along, good on you. You are a trooper, and thank you for tuning in. By the way, I'm Sean Scribner. I'm the pastor here at EMC, and if you are just tuning in for the first time, I just want to introduce myself to you. Normally, I don't teach Bible study on Wednesday nights. I handed that duty over several years ago to a very gifted layperson here in our church named Richard, and Richard will be resuming Bible study at the conclusion of this series on the 22nd. So as you look at the schedule here next to me, tonight, November, I'm still trying to get my orientation after being under the weather for a couple weeks. So bear with me. And I also, by the way, have very little energy and a cough. So if you hear me cough, you probably won't hear it. You'll probably see it. I'll probably kill the mic so I can clear my throat. So you'll see it, but you won't hear it. But if I happen to collapse, just give me a minute to regain my strength, and then I'll be back up and ready to finish the lesson. But September 8th is tonight. We are starting the last chapter here, chapter 7. We're going to do the first half of the chapter, and then next week will be the last lesson in this grueling marathon series that began all the way back at the beginning of June. But we will finish that up next week, barring any acts of God. The following week, the 22nd, that will be a special night here at the church. We're going to not only start a new Bible study series, but that Bible study series will be taking place in the Fellowship Hall. So for those of you who have in the past enjoyed coming out in person and enjoying Bible study, come back. We will be having it in person live in the Fellowship Hall like we used to do. Now, for those of you who can't make it or just for whatever reason don't feel comfortable, we're going to do our best to stream it, but we still have some details to work out on that yet. But we're going to try to do both, so we're going to try to accommodate everybody as best we can. But also that night, on the 22nd, we are resuming family night suppers. So if you're able, come out at, I guess that would be 5:30 for dinner, and then for your kids at 6:30, we have children's ministry, youth ministry, choir practice, and then at 7, we'll be having Bible study in the Fellowship Hall. And I know people are worried about COVID, and I get it. There's concern, there's elevation in some cases, all that stuff. I understand that. But at the same time, we can't put life on hold forever. So we are going to do our best to offer the gospel in all the different mediums that we can. We're going to do it wisely, but we're going to do it boldly. And if you're able to come, put a mask on. The Fellowship Hall's large. You can spread out. But we need to be together. So if you're able, please come and partake of Richard's tremendous Bible study. I know it's going to be tremendous because he's a very gifted Bible study, Bible teacher. I would never have offered him Bible study on Wednesday nights if I wasn't confident in his teaching giftedness. And he's going to be teaching from 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. So that should be a very interesting study. And if he goes at the speed that I go, it should last, you know, couple years. So I don't know, it won't be that long, but it's not like Deuteronomy, which took him forever. Richard, I know you're watching, so that was for you. Okay, so this week, next week, done with Micah. 22nd, family night, supper, Bible study with Richard and Fellowship Hall, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. As always tonight, put your prayer requests in the comment section. We're going to pray at the conclusion of the lesson. And we're also going to pray that there's no more bad weather. I don't know about where you are right now, but here on the church campus, about an hour ago, there was some lightning and thunder that took the power out for 20 seconds or so. I don't think there's any more of that stuff coming our way right now, but if for some reason this stream cuts out, it's probably that. So just hang in there. We'll get it back up and running as soon as we can and try to finish out. But I don't think that's going to happen, especially because we're going to pray for it right now. Lord, we thank you for this night. Thank you for demonstrating over the last couple of weeks in very real and tangible ways just how present you are in the midst of difficulty and challenge and busyness and pressures. Not just in my life, but in everyone here tuning in tonight or whenever this is watched. Every one of us has stuff that we're going through in life. The road through a broken world is always going to be bumpy and perilous, and it's going to be marked by difficulty and suffering. And yet, you have demonstrated time and time again how good you are, how great you are, how faithful you are. You're not just content to equip us with something detached from yourself and send us on our way. No, you yourself are with us through it all. And at times, Lord, you're the one that carries us. And so so wherever we are tonight, may those truths descend deep into our minds and our hearts and give us encouragement and strength and conviction to face all that lies ahead of us tonight and tomorrow and the rest of our days. Lord, speak through the prophet tonight and teach us how to be a people in the midst of suffering and in the midst of a broken world. And we pray that all that will result in your glory, honor, and praise. And that's what we want for tonight out of this study. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right. Let's review. That's our custom. It's been a couple weeks, so let's just kind of touch on some of these key themes we've been looking at in recent sessions. God, of course, is permitting the invasion of outside forces in the form of the Assyrians as an instrument of his judgment and wrath and discipline to come and disperse and to take into captivity his people. And yet, the promise through the prophet who's issuing this warning in this judgment is that he will also preserve and provide for his people. Now, the people of Israel are going to have to learn the hard way that God's ways are greater than their own. And his plan for them, and by extension, all people of faith living in this world, is not to just remove difficulties from their life. He's not just going to come in and sweep aside the coming hordes of invaders. No. He's not content to do that. He doesn't want them to continue to live in their own self-sufficiency. No, but instead, his plan is to use his instruments of discipline to bring his people to a place of radical dependence upon him. That's what he wants. He wants to be their shepherd. And if he's going to be your shepherd, you have to be a sheep. Now, of course, we all know, like sheep, we've gone astray. We get that. But he wants us to hear his voice and come to him for protection and provision and guidance and direction, to be a part of his sheepfold. And those of us who insist on going our own way need rescue. And that is what God is doing and offering here. And it's what he does ultimately through his son, the one who has come to seek and save the lost. Now, last time we met, we returned for second, third, fourth time in our study throughout this book, because there's recurring themes throughout the chapters, to the topic of justice. And one of the things we identified last week is that it is true, justice is, in a sense, punishment for wrongdoing. If someone has perpetrated an injustice, then justice is required to give them what is due if they have violated a rule or a law or a standard or another. But justice, biblically speaking, and just in general, is also standing up for those who cannot stand for themselves, that being victims and the powerless, the vulnerable, the weak, and giving them their dues. If someone has been stripped of justice, then not only is the perpetrator to be held accountable, but the restoration of their justice is also the right thing to do. So it's more than just about punishing wrongs. It's about creating a society where everything is right, where all have the opportunity to flourish and thrive, not opportunity of or equality of outcome. We know what happens when that's the emphasis. The emphasis of outcome always results in devastation of a society, of a culture, of a nation. But equality of opportunity and God's shalom, wholeness to be realized in the lives of all people. This is the justice that God expects from a people who love him, and he'll settle for nothing less. All right, here's that moment I told you where I was going to mute the mic so I could cough. So give me 1 second to clear my throat. All right. Going to be a whole lot of that tonight, probably. Let's go and dive into our text here. We're in Micah chapter 7, verse 1. We're going to be doing the first seven verses, and we're going to be in the New American Standard, which we have done throughout this study. Verse 1 says, "Woe to me, for I am like harvests of summer fruit, like gleanings of grapes. There is not a cluster of grapes left to eat, nor an early fig which I crave. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among mankind. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. As for evil, both hands do it well. The leader asks for a bribe, also the judge, and the great one speaks the capricious desire of his soul. So they plot it together. The best of them is like a thorn bush, the most upright like a thorn hedge. The day when you post your watchman, your punishment is coming. Then their confusion will occur. Do not trust in a neighbor. Do not have confidence in a close friend. Guard your lips from her who lies in your arms. For son disavows father. Daughter rises up against her mother. Daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A person's enemies are the people of his own household. But as for me, I will be on the watch for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me." In chapter 7, we find the prophet is personally processing all the things that are happening before him and all that is about to take place. He's deeply affected by it all on a very emotional level, but even an existential level, by how his people have torn themselves apart, how their society is unraveling. And it ultimately forces us to ask the question, how does God want us to deal with the difficulties and the injustices and the sufferings that we see in this world? Is it just to ignore them? Is it to just, you know, kind of get over them and move on, go about our business? Is it to just power through? Is it to be crushed by them? I think the answer to all those is no. And Micah is going to lead the way for us here. He's going to show us how to respond in the midst of all these things in his time, but by extension, our time. And it's that is through the act of lament. Lament, that's correct. That is pouring out our sorrows to God. I mean, what is lament, after all? Well, at base, it's a passionate expression of grief and sorrow. It's mourning, it's grieving. It's not whining, it's not grumbling. You know biblically that those are very sinful responses. Those are self-centered. Those are faithless reactions to things in the world. But neither is lament something just superficial or trite, some sort of glib expression. It's real, okay? It's real. It's, to take a very tangible physical expression, it's to beat one's chest in anguish. It's to say, like Micah and others in the scriptures, "Woe to me," or "What misery is mine?" That popular expression you've seen all throughout the Bible. It's one that perhaps you might tend to associate with, you know, a pity party. Think Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. You know, nobody loves me. You know, nobody cares about me. No one is interested in my problems, whatever. It's feeling sorry for oneself. But in the scriptures, "woe to me" or "woe is me" is never that. It's instead a very real, perhaps most powerful and deepest felt expression that you'll find. It's one reserved for the most dire and grim and ruinous types of circumstances. It's It's the cry of a mother who has lost her child. It's the grief and the mourning and the expression of a spouse who has lost her his or her spouse, a widow, a widower. It's the cry of a conquered nation. It's been stripped of all that it has. You remember Isaiah in chapter 6 when he's, you know, whisked away into the very throne room of heaven, the temple of God. And he sees the Holy One and he knows right away what that means. To be in the presence of that means his own annihilation. Woe to me, for I have seen the Holy One. Okay, that's lament. And the Bible doesn't shy away from it. As a matter of fact, it's so commonplace in the scriptures, you can't miss it. Take the Psalms, for example. 60 of the 150 of them, that's some 40% of the Psalms, are Psalms of lament, the heart's cry in grief to God. The prophets, of course, are no strangers to lament. Take Jeremiah, for example, who was nicknamed the weeping prophet in the letter of Lamentations, the book of Lamentations. It's a whole book of the Bible is named after lament. You see, the Bible doesn't shy away from the worst realities of the human experience. After all, if the Bible doesn't take seriously the sufferings and the problem of sufferings in the world, if it didn't take those things seriously, well, then we would have no reason to take the Bible seriously, at least in my opinion. There is no easy, quick, superficial handling of the very worst of what is common to all of our lives in the Bible, as if, you know, the problem of suffering isn't some real thing to be dealt with, something that's serious and experienced by every single person that's ever lived. The Bible does not ignore the wounds of the world. It draws near to them. It shows us how to process and handle and respond to suffering rightly. One of the best classes I ever took in college was a J-term class. Now, J-term at my college at the time meant January term. So you had, you know, your fall semester, your spring semester, and of course there were some summer courses if you want to take summer classes. But in January, which is normally, you know, the winter break, you could take sort of like a concentrated class called J-term. It's like a whole term squeezed into a week. And I took one of those one year on Jeremiah Lamentations. And now on the surface, that sounds like a pretty depressing class, but honestly, it was maybe my favorite class I took in 4 years of college. And for the professor who taught it, who by the way, was also a very dear friend of mine, a mentor, a discipler, years later, we still reflected back on that J-term class where we went through those books of the Bible together. And he agreed it was maybe his favorite one to teach in all the years he taught at the Bible College. We read books like A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis. I don't know if you knew this or not, but C.S. Lewis was married and his wife passed. And he wrote a book reflecting on his journey through that suffering. Powerful book. I strongly recommend you read it, whether or not you've ever lost someone you love, just because of the deep insights and perspectives his experience gave him, formed, of course, by the worldview of Scripture. We also read a book called Lament for a Son by Nicholas Wolterstorff. Another just powerful insight into the journey of one who has suffered deep loss and grief and pain and lament. And through that class, I was able to see for the first time in my life, I feel like, the purpose and the function of lament in the life of a Christian living in this broken world. It's not hopeless despair. To lament is, as a Christian, is not hopeless despair. It is just a honest cry directed to God. The honest cry of those who see the truth and the toll of the miseries in the world and has nowhere else to go but to Him. And Micah is going to show us in these verses how and when to lament rightly. And he laments three things. And again, these are there's a cyclical nature to these themes in this book. You know, chapter one, we're focusing on this topic. In chapter two, it's this topic. In chapter three, it's this. And then he's going to return to these things. And he's doing the same thing here. So while this might feel like review, it's worth looking at again. What are the things that cause the heart of the prophet to break and cry out to God? Well, the first is the absence of the righteous. Notice how he begins there in verse 1. He's basically saying the good fruit of righteousness is nowhere for him or anyone else to find and enjoy among the people. Verse 1, he likens himself to the vine dresser who goes to his plants to collect the fruit at harvest time, only to find them picked clean. Now, for people like me who have just a couple little tomato plants, you know, to go out one day and find all my tomatoes missing would be irritating, but they're not, it's not the end of the world. But for someone who relied on their harvest for their livelihood and their survival, tangible expressions even for the people of this time of God's own presence and covenantal faithfulness to them, to go and find your fruit gone is devastating. And he likens himself to someone like that, only the harvest he's looking for is a harvest of righteousness among the people of God. And he says, no, the godly man has perished from the land. He's nowhere to be found. No one is righteous. And all that remains in the land are the hands of evil men who have picked the people clean in exploitation. The best of them, he says in verse 4, is like a thorn bush. The most upright that you'll find is like a thorn hedge. In other words, they're fruitless people who are painful to the touch. And instead of a loving community of people looking out for and caring for one another, he sees a people, in verse 2, lying in wait for bloodshed, hunting one another with nets, people who prey on one another, people who subdue and crush one another for personal gain. There's an absolute absence of righteousness and righteous living among his people. And here's the thing. The expectations of God for his people in the Old Testament are no different in the New. In fact, I would say they're greater in the New. Take what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4. If you've ever read Ephesians, I know, I'm sure all of you have, multiple times, but you'll remember this well, where Paul says in chapter 4, you didn't learn that way from Christ. That is, that unrighteous way of living for yourself and exploiting others and, you know, being about your own business. Crushing and subduing and lying in wait with a net to trap others and, you know, sort of this bloodthirsty way of relating to the world. You didn't learn that from Christ. Since you've heard about Jesus and have learned the truth that comes for him, you are to throw off your old sinful nature and your former way of life, which is corrupted by lust and deception. Instead, let the Spirit renew your thoughts and attitudes. Put on your new nature, created to be like God. How? How? Truly righteous and holy. Not just some imputed righteousness that comes from Christ at you, but an imparted righteousness and holiness from Christ in you and through you. It's as if when Paul says you are to be truly righteous and holy, he's not just saying Christ's righteousness is to robe you like a garment. Yes, that's part of it. But when he talks about taking off your sinful nature, that's something that has to do with the very inside of who you are. Remove that and put on him around you and in you. Let him live his righteousness and holiness through you by the power of his Spirit. And what does that look like? Well, he'll go on to say in the following verses, don't lie, tell the truth. Don't steal, but work and be generous with the fruit of your labors. Don't let anger cause you to sin. Watch your language. You know, if you're going to use words, don't use them to tear down and to be profane. Use them to edify and to build up and encourage one another. It's interesting to me how every single one of those implications of being truly, of true righteousness and holiness in the Christian's life is relational. Every single one of them. These are the implications of God's sanctifying work in a believer's life. It's not the list of do's and don'ts. I don't watch R-rated movies. I don't, you know, do this bad thing or that bad thing as if you're sort of experiencing holiness in some sort of bubble. Now, we can debate R-rated movies. I'm not talking, what I'm saying is every single implication of this for Paul, of putting on your new nature, created after Christ in true righteousness and holiness, results in right relationship with another. Every single one of them. Wesley famously said, there is no holiness but social holiness. It's not, you're living on some mountain somewhere extracted from the world, you know, holy. No, it's you are relating rightly, truth and love, pure, like Christ, who's forming you after himself, who's living his life through you in the world. It's powerful and amazing. And God has always wanted that from his people, to be a holy priesthood of believers. And Micah says, when I look around, I don't see it anywhere, anywhere. And he laments. Secondly, this goes along with the first point is, and we've talked about this before too, the corruption of Israel's leaders. Verse 3, look at the different types of people with responsibility he refers to here. He says, the leader asks for a bribe. Also the judge and the great one speaks the capricious desire of his soul. So they plot it together. Basically, all of the people entrusted to be stewards of their God-given authority for the benefit of the others, all of them are corrupted. All of them. And instead of weaving peace into their society, they weave evil and injustice and discord. And it is always an opportunity for lament when power is corrupted. And can't help but think of our own nation, where you see corruption of power at every level of government, from the bottom to the top. Regardless of party, there's ample accusation to go all around here. Now, you could say some more than others, but that's another discussion for another time. But the point is, anytime you see that in the leadership of a society, it's an opportunity for lament. And thirdly, the disintegration of civil society. Micah says in verses 5 and 6, which I believe are among the saddest verses in all of this book, if not the most sad. Do not trust in a neighbor. Man, I don't know what kind of neighbors you have. I don't know a lot of our neighbors here in this here on Old Okiska Road. I've met several of them. Of course, I know the Nellums, a couple houses down. I've met the folks catty corner here, but then they moved out and that house is being sold. And I've met the neighbors at the end of the parking lot a couple times, but they tend not to be, you know, places where I can interact with them. And times I've walked down the road and knocked on doors, most of the time no one ever answers their doors. Made some friends with a couple kind of this direction, kind of on the other side of our field. But the ones I have met, I trust. And that's a wonderful thing to have neighbors you can trust. But Micah says, don't trust your neighbor. And even worse, do not have confidence in a close friend. Guard your lips from her who lies in your arms. For son disavows father, daughter rises up against mother, daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. A person's enemies are the peoples of his own household. It's one thing when there are no righteous people, you know, out there, and the leaders are corrupted by their power. But Micah says that the evil is right next door. The evil is at your doorstep. The evil is lying in bed next to you. And of course, the evil is in the right, in the center of you. There is no safe, trustworthy sort of sanctuary of a life-giving relationship to be found in anyone's life right now. Every person is in it for themselves. If ever there was a situation to lament regarding the people of God, that is it right there. You take, once again, the exhortations of the apostle. I mean, the entirety of Ephesians is ultimately about being God's new society in this world. And all of his theology, going back to from before the beginning of time and God's purposes in creation, to how that theology is worked out in practice, is about being the community, that image, that bear the image of the triune God for the salvation of the world. And nothing is more pitiful and lamentable than when the people of God are not what they're called to be. And that's exactly what's happening here. When society, as God has designed it to be a place of life and joy and holiness and shalom, is reduced to a living hell. And you and I can look at our own world for the very things that God moves upon the prophet, resulting in lament in his soul. And you and I need to be moved by those same things to join God in his lament. We're not just the ones lament. We join God in his lament for the way things are in the world. But also, and this is the key, and really the turning point here in Micah's, this chapter here, this last chapter of Micah, you and I are also challenged to find in faith that turning to Him in our lament is what we need for rescue and restoration. And He invites us to join Him in His work to redeem it all and ultimately enter into the joy of His great salvation. So, we find ourselves here coming to verse 7 and beholding the hope of lament, or even the hope in lament. Now, the Bible, we've already noted, the Bible is realistic about the problems of suffering in the world. But its realism about the suffering in the world would not be beneficial to us if it also did not offer a solution to the suffering. And I find in the scriptures a balance unmatched by any of the world's religious, you know, worldview systems. Either suffering is merely an illusion, you know, something that's not really real, or it's real, but there's no ultimate or true remedy for it. That's what you find everywhere else in every system of the world. You either have an inadequate view of suffering or an inadequate solution for it. But fortunately for us, we have the scriptures. And they are not like, you know, when you go to a doctor who, and they are either unable to diagnose it, your problem, or they diagnose it rightly and it's treatable, but they offer no cure. What good is that kind of a doctor? We need both. We need the right diagnosis, but we also need the right remedy, and the Bible offers both. We live in a time when the suffering of the world is constantly crossing, you know, our screens. You know, we live in the digital age where, you know, we've got the constant notifications, breaking news, you know, the 24-hour news cycles, breaking updates flashing across their screen. I was talking with the group of friends at the anniversary dinner Sunday afternoon there out on the parking lot under the tent. And we were laughing. I was talking with Chelsea Wortman at this point. We're laughing about how in our OCD, or as I like to call it, ATD, attention to detail, in our ATD, neither of us can stand those little red icons that you get on your screen. Let's see if I have any. Okay, I've got three. You probably can't see them very well at all. In fact, I'm not going to bother. But there's, you know, there's one there on my Facebook app, and there's an email, and, you know, oh, there's a couple more. You know, I can't stand those. And so I'm constantly, every time I pick up my phone, I see them. You know, I got to see what I got, you know, whatever. That's the day we live in, with notifications popping up and breaking updates and 24-hour news cycles, and the headlines everywhere you turn are full of terrible things. And some people think the world has never been as bad as it is. That may be true. But it is also true that the world has never had access to the terrible things that happen all around it like we do today. So are there really more storms and earthquakes and fires today than ever before? Maybe. But we also haven't had access to the awareness of those things like we do today. You know, if there's an earthquake in Haiti, we know at the moment it happens. If there's a mudslide in China, it flashes across your screen. If there's a wildfire in California, which it seems like that state is, the West Coast is always burning all the time. It's right there on your screen. We're aware of it all the time. And what happens is, it's hard for you and me. Maybe it's just hard for me, I don't know, but it seems it's hard for us to truly lament what seems commonplace and, relatively speaking, distant. You know, we lament the things that happen directly to us, right? But because we're so used to seeing mass shootings, you know, political corruption, you know, tragedy, we're so used to seeing it, and it's all out there, most of it. We become, what, numb to it, don't we? Of course, the alternative to that seems to be, if we truly allow ourselves to be moved by it, it almost drives us to despair. And so we're caught. How do we navigate this world? Well, what does Micah do? He hopes in his suffering. I'm sorry, he hopes in his lament. There's hope in his lament. He's realistic about what's going on, but where does he go with it? What does he do with it? Verse 7, as for me, hey, Can't trust anyone. You can't trust your neighbor. You can't trust your leaders. You know, there's no one righteous out there. Your own spouse is not trustworthy. You can't trust anyone but for me. What do I do in the midst of my brokenness and my lament? I will be on watch for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. And there's three actions here in that verse that I want to take a cue from when answering the question of how we are to lament, the way, the manner, the things that should drive us to, we've seen the things that drive him to lament, but here's how he does it in our lives. He looks, he waits, and he trusts. Now, you can find all sorts of stories in the Gospels even that provide a picture of this. Take, for example, in Luke chapter 7, the Roman centurion. Remember that story? He's got a sick servant. He sends a delegation, ironically enough, of Jews, which reinforces the point of the story that this was a righteous man, an upright man, because Jews and centurions weren't exactly friends. But apparently this one had been God-fearing, helped them build their synagogue, was respected, and so they were willing to go on his behalf. And so they go to Jesus, they tell him what's going on, Jesus on his way back, and while he's coming there, the centurion sends out another delegation to meet him on his way. And this is what it says in verses 6 and 7 of Luke chapter 7. When Jesus was not yet far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to enter under my roof. For that reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant shall be healed." So you see, in a very beautiful illustration of what Micah says he'll do in verse 7. In his humility and his faith, the centurion looked to Jesus, waited for Jesus, and trusted in Jesus. And of course, in verse 9, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at the centurion and turned and said to the crowd that was following along, "I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith." And that servant was healed. Now the centurion, of course, is neither the last nor I would even say the best example of this behavior in the Gospels. Jesus himself demonstrated hope in lament. Take Luke 19, when Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. The writer of Hebrews, in I would say is almost a commentary on this event, said this in Hebrews 5:7, "In the days of his humanity, he offered up both prayers and pleas with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his devout behavior." Jesus looked to his Father and waited upon his Father and trusted in his Father in all things. Who could forget the most agonizing cry of lament in all of human history? As Jesus cries out from the cross in Mark chapter 15, in the words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, this is a unique lament in all of the scriptures. So you have to view it a little differently. I think at the heart, you can say all the things we've been saying tonight about this, but there's a nuance to it that is unique to this moment in time. Regardless of what we say and whatever nuances we find in this lament, it is not the cry of the hopeless, but of the servant who suffers. This is the experience of Isaiah 53, the one who suffers on behalf of others, the one who aligned his will with the Father. So this is the Son subjecting himself in agreement with the purposes of his Father. So on the surface, it looks hopeless, and it's because he's embodying our hopelessness apart from God because of sin. So as Jesus experiences the fullness of the abandonment that sin causes, the alienation in the suffering of separation that sin produces. This is his cry, but he does it with the hope of resurrection. I think Hebrews 5 also speaks to that cry of lament, if not more so to that cry of lament. He offered up prayers and pleas with loud crying and tears to the one who is able to do what? Save him from death. And he was heard. Now God carried out the plan in a different manner than what Jesus in his humanity was crying for. You left me. As he experiences our suffering and our alienation. And God did, in a relational sense, abandon him. Because he became sin who knew no sin. But his abandonment wasn't forever. As we all know the end of the story. That he was raised in glorious resurrection. And this here, friends, is my point. This is where we go in our lament as Christians. To the cross. To the cross. It's there where we find that the holy, all-powerful creator God of the universe, we find that he's neither distant nor aloof nor oblivious or even unconcerned with the suffering of the world, but rather he enters right into the center of it. Right there is the first answer to the problem of evil that the scriptures provide. God is not untouched by it, but he enters right into the center of it. He subjects himself to it, and he even experiences it in a deeper way than you and I ever have to. You and I will never bear the weight of the sins of the world. But Jesus did. Jesus did on the cross. It is there where we find that he is a God who will never turn his back on the objects of his love and affection, because Jesus has already taken the fullness of our sin upon himself and its consequences upon himself in our place and on our behalf. He's done it for us already. The very alienation and isolation and judgment that it was ours, he took so that we don't have to. And God will never promises he'll never turn his back on us if we look to his son. The one whose own prayers to the Father for nearness were rejected in order that our own prayers to the Father for nearness would be heard and answered. He's the one who drank the full cup of God's wrath poured out on all sin and evil and injustice, that we might immerse ourselves into the cup of his blessing. And I don't know about you, but when we think about the cross and we think about how that's the place where we go to lament because of who Jesus is and what he has done on our behalf, that is something that should both melt our hearts in humility while solidifying our hearts with conviction. So that, yes, our hearts should be broken by the true horror of the condition of the world. It is my sin that Jesus is bearing. That the pain that we see there, not just the physical pain, but the pain, the anguish of his soul, was because of me. And that should bring us to a place of deep humility, but never to the point of despair. We can and must at the cross lament in a confident sadness, one that moves us to look to and wait for and trust in Jesus. We cry out to a father who will never turn his face away from his sons and daughters. And because of who he is, like Micah, we can say, as for me, I will be on the watch for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Which brings us to our questions of application for conclusion. Is your heart broken for the suffering of the world tonight? Do the injustices of our nation, of our state, of our community move you at all at the level of the heart? Do you lament the absence of righteous men and women around us or in the church? The abject, blatant, unrepented corruption of power. The ever-increasing disintegration of our civil society. It's happening all around us. And if your heart is at all aligned with the heart of God, then the answer at some point here has to be yes. And if the answer is no, then you have to do some serious self-evaluation here and ask why. Why is our heart not moved to lament for these things? But then lastly, here's the challenge of the night. Will you by faith look to and wait upon and trust in the Christ of the cross? If so, then if we are ever moved to lament, you can hope in it. You can hope in the Christ of the cross, the one who brings justice to both evil and the victim, the one who gives justice and mercy, the one who makes a way for his own people to have the injustice and evil within their own hearts to be rooted out, that we might be his holy priesthood who gives their lives away for the sake of the world. All the hope of that is found in him alone and through him alone, and it's for his glory alone.